Merhaba there, Hosh Geldiniz. Hello and a warm welcome to Talking Round North Cyprus, the only podcast that deals exclusively with the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus. I'm Sarah Palmer, and I have to say, I'm really excited that we have as our special guest the multi-award-winning travel writer Sarah Woods, who, having travelled the world and could have lived anywhere she wanted to, has decided to settle in North Cyprus and make it her home. So we're going to hear from her a little bit later on. But before that, of course, it would be very remiss of me not to say hello to my co-presenter, sunning himself out there in North Cyprus, although probably, Roger, you're melting a little bit, aren't you? I mean, I was going to send you a picture of the rain from here in the UK, but I know there's actually been some quite severe weather. I mean, I know we all like it hot, but there's hot and there's hot.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, we're at the eastern extremity, if you like, of the heat wave that's hitting the whole of the Mediterranean area. Yeah, we are melting a bit and we could sure do with some of your rain.
I shall bring it over with me when I come over in less than a month. I'll put it in a little jam jar, obviously less than 100 millilitres, but I'll bring a little bit for you. But we'll take care anyway. I mean, I know you sort of get acclimatised to it, but even so, extreme heat can be quite dangerous. I'm sure you're managing. As long as you stay in the air conditioning and keep that wine cool, you'll be fine. My top tip for the day. Anyway, I obviously follow quite closely what's going on in the TRNC, and I've seen over Facebook and various other social media that there's one topic above all others that seems to be making hot news, literally hot news where you are. A certain British High Commissioner not exactly endearing himself to the expat community, those of you living in the TRNC. So what's been kicking off?
Well, Sarah, the British High Commissioner to Cyprus, Erfan Siddik, he met a load of expats here in the north, and on the face of it, it appeared to be a good idea, you know, for him to hear firsthand the difficulties facing us because of the isolation, etc. But my goodness, what happened was he created an absolute inferno. Now, I don't know who his guidance people are who writes his scripts for him, but he described the second phase of Turkey's 1974 peace operation as a land grab. He actually likened it to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Good grief.
And if you read the history books, yeah, the first phase and the second phase, you couldn't have one without the other. It wouldn't work. What he failed to say about the second phase of the peace operation was, you know, it followed the women and kids being massacred in the little villages here in North Cyprus. The British expats actually really went for him verbally, and there was absolute uproar. He also accused this Mr. Siddik of the TRNC authorities. He said they're trying to cause pain for anyone who's not adhering to or accepting their worldview. And he said it makes it harder for the British government to help on occasions. Absolute rubbish. And what's come out of this, Sarah, is everyone that was there is saying he was just being a mouthpiece for the Greek Cypriots. It's completely unacceptable. And there are lots of calls for his resignation. People are saying he shouldn't be doing the job he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I saw some of, well, in fact, you sent me the pages from Cyprus today. And you're right. I mean, I don't know who's advising him. I mean, it sounds like it's been written by Greek Cypriots, doesn't it? And I know the UK Foreign Office has their view, but it should be balanced. And he should, you know, at the end of the day, he's there to represent and look after British citizens. That's your thing. I mean, I was British Vice Consul in Geneva. You know, I didn't sort of, not that there was any Swiss bias or anything like that, but you're there basically to help the Brits with their problems and that sort of thing. Yeah, as you say, I don't know who was briefing him, but what the consequences will be if it gets back to the powers that be. I don't know, will be any consequences. That's the thing. Interestingly, I know, Roger, that some of the people that have featured in our previous podcasts were actually in the audience that day. So they've given you their take on what went on. Is that right?
Yes. Paul and Nigel Wollaston-Evans from Health and Wellbeing North Cyprus. They were on our podcast just two or three editions ago. I asked them, because they were there, What was your impression of the British High Commissioner after the meeting? And they say, as one of was two of many expats sitting in the meeting's audience, our blood boiled, say Paul and Nigel, at his ignorance, at his arrogance. Referring to the second phase of the Turkish peace operation as a land grab, and that the demand for sovereign equality of the TRNC would not be accepted. Now, Paul and Nigel say quite clearly, it's obvious that who should represent UK expats on the island, not just the South. It's time he left. And our old friend Izzy Atahassan also said, look, I felt Roger was repeating Greek Cypriot, perhaps from what he was fed in the South by their politicians. If he wasn't doing that and it was really from his own mind, then he needed to be better educated, informed and or advised. But Izzy said, up to the point of being asked questions, Izzy said, I found the meeting quite informative. But then what's happened, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office gave a statement out, Sarah, that the British High Commissioner's words were misinterpreted. And that's made the audience there blood boil even more, because they were there and they heard him say these things. So again, Paul and Nigel, I asked them, you know, what do they think about the FOC's words? They say the comments from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are a blatant cover-up job and an attempt at damage limitation. There were so many expats there that heard the words of the British High Commissioner and I'm sure would verify what he said. Now, if the British High Commissioner is merely a puppet for the UK government, Paul and Nigel say there is little point in him visiting the North. And Izzy was just as strong. He said, I was shocked at what the Foreign and Commonwealth Office then said, because I heard what I heard with my own ears. We all witnessed it. What was reported was very accurate. There was nothing false. He said the Foreign and Commonwealth Office effectively are calling us all liars.
Ooh.
It's steaming over here. I tell you, Sarah, it's absolutely steaming.
Yeah, because I know our friend Eltan Halil from Cyprus Today, I mean, he reported on it, didn't he? And he asked him questions sort of at the end. And it seemed to, from what I understand, it sort of got a little bit heated. And he was like, oh, you know, don't quote me on this sort of thing. But I mean, Eltan is, you know, straight up, you know, and he says it as it is. So, you know, as you say, so many people heard what he said. It really is a cover up. And he should just come out and apologise, really. But it sounds like it's gone too far for that now.
Well, that was a headline in last week's Cyprus Today. Apologise. It's just one word. And no, Eltan, apparently, according to people that were there again, was very calm and collected, because he was sort of intimidated by the British High Commissioner, because he said, I don't want you to quote what I've said here, or there will be consequences. I mean, what sort of language is that?
Yeah, how dare you threaten people?
And apparently Eltan kept very calm, was completely, as you say, Sarah, as you would expect, completely professional about the whole thing, and he reported every word of it. So good old Eltan.
Old Eltan. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, what a shambles! What a shambles! And it's sad, isn't it? Because it just sets back any goodwill that anybody might have had. I mean, to begin with, as you said, everybody was like, well, you know, this is good. This is good that he's reaching out to the North, coming to see people in the North, you know, and that sort of thing. And then to just, like, you know, light the touch paper. And I don't know what the Turkish Cypriots think about it. I mean, well, we've got Izzy's take on it there. You know, I mean, I know the expats were furious, but Turkish Cypriots must be as well.
Absolutely. And it brings to mind that famous scene from Monty Python. I feel like saying, what good has a British High Commissioner ever done for North Cyprus? And the answer, of course, is sod all.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Because I'm guessing that if you did have a problem, and anybody listening to this may be able to sort of tell us, maybe they've been involved, but I'm guessing if you had a problem in the TRNC that you need repatriated or you needed help, I mean, you're supposed to be able to go to the British High Commission and get help, but I guess that's not how it works.
If you're in the North and choose to live in the North, as we found out recently when a friend of ours passed away, you won't get any help. Not really. There's just no point even asking, to be honest. You're just going through the motions. As far as a lot of expats are concerned, the British High Commissioner is a waste of space. I mean, we're talking about all British High Commissioners here, not just Mr. Siddique. What is the point? A lot of people who live here in the north are saying. Anyway, onwards and upwards. And like you, Sarah, I'm so excited to share our interview with travel writer guru Sarah Woods on our podcast. You and me were both spellbound at times when we chatted to her just a few days ago.
Yes, I know. She's one of these people that she's like, I wanted to do that. I want to be her friend. And it's funny, we have quite a lot in common. I don't think we've ever met, but I think we have quite a lot in common. You know, our birthdays are quite close together. She does South America, that sort of thing. She loves the TRNC, all sorts of bits and pieces. And as you'll hear, has a bit of a Leicester connection as well. So anyway, yes, as I say, a remarkable lady in every sense. And we're both delighted that Sarah agreed to join us. One thing I imagine most of us would want to know, after going around the planet goodness knows how many times and having stayed in some of the most exotic and out of this world places, how come Sarah Woods decided to settle in little old North Cyprus?
It's such a like a coincidence. I think sometimes, you know, you want to take credit for being astute in noticing a place that's on the up or that you carefully, strategically plan something. I mean, it was purely coincidental. I had friends that were renting out here long term, and they said, come on over. And so I did, and I just fell in love with it. It was so unlike everywhere else I was traveling to at the time. It felt like I was close to Europe, so close to home compared to some of the other places. I felt like I was just a few hours away from England. And a house came up that was near one of my favourite beaches. So I was in the middle of writing my first book, and they called me at a really busy time and said, there's a house that's come up, it's a really good price. And I asked the question, can I see the beach? And they were like, yeah, you can see the beach, right? And they sent me some photos from the windows. And I made a snap decision because I've got a deadline to meet and I had loads of other things on my mind. And so I bought a house via a telephone conversation. And that was in 2001, so 20 odd years ago. And that was how I came to kind of find this place. Just invitation over, a snap conversation. It would be nice to have a little place by the beach here. Suddenly it became a reality.
Yeah, I can resonate with that because I was over visiting Roger for it was a half term. My children were with their dad, and his wife said, "Oh, there are still places free in the other in the new apartments." They'd only got to the fifth floor, and by the time I got on the plane that evening, a pound deposit down, and Chrissy was my power of attorney, and off I went. So yeah, I and again, you just have a nice feel for it. That's the thing, isn't it?
Right. I think if you something must connect on an emotional level, I think. And for me, certainly, having visited so many places in the world where there was no longer any frontline beach that could be seen, and no beaches which on a July summer's afternoon you could walk in complete isolation. I've watched whales breaching from my balcony. I've seen, you know, some of the remaining seal colonies here. I've seen dolphins. I mean, where I am in the Carpaz is particularly blessed. I know that. And there are changes and there is development. But there really aren't pockets of the world that are like this anymore. And being so into my nature, that just having all of that and more on my doorstep, it just felt like paradise.
You've traveled the world, I don't know how many times. I mean, your travelogue is just unbelievable. But where did this passion come from? I mean, there must have been a seed somewhere, and you said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go around the world and see everywhere.
I don't know. I'm the daughter of two civil servants who have got no expedition kind of desire in them. We used to go to Worthing on an occasional holiday. I mean, I don't know where it came from, but I think my parents said that, you know, even when I was before I was born and I was in my mum's tummy, I was wriggling around like I was impatient to get moving. And as soon as I was out, I was desperate to walk. And I think if there's a curiosity about the world, if you feel like there's stuff to see and you're impatient to get on with it, and you know that there's life beyond your living room or beyond your town or beyond your region or beyond your country, whatever it may be, I think there's from that is born desire. And I can only remember as a child, we didn't have a television. We used to draw. There was me and my siblings. We used to draw, pore over books. And we were given books. And one of them was an encyclopedia with amazing maps and the flags of the world and, you know, sort of sample sayings in different languages. And it's amazing as children how you can find entertainment, hours and hours and hours of entertainment from that. So we would just every day, what's your favourite flag? What's your favourite saying? How do you say, you know, this in Zimbabwean? What's this flag? We just used to challenge each other. And I loved some of the language and how it rolled off the tongue. The sound of it was seductive to me, you know, especially Latin American. And I just was crazy curious and I wanted to see what was out there. I've got no other explanation than that, really.
I see that you went to Florida International University. So that's quite an unusual one to go to. How did you end up there?
So I was at a very normal primary school. But in those days, they could, if they felt that you were doing well, they could just pluck you out and put you in a higher year. I'm not sure it's as simple now, but that's what happened. So I was in a higher year learning with older children. There was three of us that did that. And as a result, I think we were monitored through our schooling and we were given opportunities, not dissimilar from the gifted child program that I think is in place today, but just without any bureaucracy. And at the time, I'd already started to do some traveling. So I was 18 and there was a exchange available that you could apply for funding for. And the confidence of youth, I mean, I honestly believe that if I'd have applied for a job as an astronaut in those days with NASA, I'd have believed I could get it. I just wrote to them and said, you know, I'm due to go to a college in Bedford. Is there somebody that would like to do an exchange with me? And so I ended up in Miami doing a part-time course, living in a house full of students of different South American, Central American nationalities, learning the language, eating the food, meeting the parents, going back to countries when we weren't studying. And I developed a real passion for that culture. I think everything was appealing to me. The way that the people moved, you know, the fluidity that they walked with, the way that they seemed to have like a syncopated rhythm of music in everything that they did, the passion in which they ate food, they talked about every mouthful, all of it I loved. Mm. And seeing a country through native eyes, that's what made me want to travel. And that's why Central and South America were my first choices.
Now, a lot of people want to know, Sarah, how do you become a travel writer? It must be one of the greatest jobs if travel is your passion. You don't see adverts saying travel writer wanted apply within. So right. What was your story? How did you get into it and become so successful?
So that actually started when I first went to Australia and people were picking tomatoes and doing those kinds of jobs, you know, off the radar work on a travel visa in which you weren't allowed to work. And I wondered, what could I do to earn a bit of money? And again, confidence of youth. I just wrote some kind of very basic stories about discovering places that were a bit off the beaten track and sent them to newspapers and they published them. I mean, I didn't for 1 minute think they'd be declined. I mean, now you would just sit there and agonize over each word. And, you know, I mean, this was the day when you wrote them longhand and you sent them off. I mean, obviously I couldn't research via Google. Like, it was just another world. But again, the advance of technology has made this job so much easier. So now people can be travel writers without having to, you know, really labor too much. I'd done a journalism course as an apprenticeship. So I was working for a local newspaper in Bedfordshire. You know, these days it's harder to get in that route, But you can set up a blog. You can start to do blogging. It's quite easy these days to become a travel influencer. It's not so difficult. You just need to, I think, have belief that you've got something new to offer. And of course, so many people write about Spain. So many people write about France. If you're going to write about those areas, you need to find something distinctly different. And I think just, I was a young travel writer in a field that was mainly aging writers who had perhaps started to freelance after a journalistic career and they were in their 50s and 60s. So as somebody in their 20s who just got unusual stuff to say, unusual way of looking at a country, I always sat down and spoke to the man on the bench, the woman making food, the guy shearing sheep. That was always my angle. And I found that these kind of experience-driven pieces, talking to the oddball on the plaza, were just different. Finding the character in the bar and, you know, finding out interesting stories. And that's how it's been ever since, really. I've avoided mainstream tourism writing in the main and just trying to offer unusual places, places that are perhaps on the curve.
I mean, I'm guessing it's not all glamorous. Have you found yourself in some tight spots now and again when you're like, I wish I hadn't started this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are all sorts of things that you have to know about yourself. Are you somebody that's impatient, you know, because you'll hate travel writing? There's so much hanging around, waiting for a bus that, you know, perhaps says it's going to come at 9:30 in the morning, but could be 4 hours either side. You've missed it even though you're an hour early, or you've got to sit there with your luggage for hours waiting. So mechanical failure, you know, you've got to be good at that. The bus breaks down, you're sitting in the heat along with everybody else while someone comes along with a, you know, trying to mend the bus. There's also kind of natural phenomenons. I've been in earthquakes, landslides, you know, terrible monsoons, rainstorms, all sorts of things like that. And also, if you really aren't one for just normal airport delays, this is going to be the worst job you've ever done in your life. You have to embrace the delay. You have to find the joy in that. And yeah, they're all the things that can be frustrating. And if you set out with too firm an idea of what your story is going to be as a writer, you know, then you're probably going to be disappointed. You need to be the sort of person that takes the offer of the cup of tea, takes the offer of lunch to come and join a family. You know, if it's hot and you're in a travel queue, go and have that swim with some of the teenagers that decide to go and cool off, because that's probably where the story is, rather than aiming to get there to do the story on the flamingo sanctuary or something.
Yeah.
You know, so stay open-minded. And also, British people, I myself included in this, we spend too much time being fearful, being nervous, watching the clock, being afraid, you know. And I learned quite quickly to ignore the stories about don't take a biscuit from a stranger on a bus journey as they'll remove your kidney because the biscuit will be laced with poison, or any of those kind of stories. Don't accept a meal, you know, because you'll have your leg amputated. You know, don't be afraid. Grasp every kind offer. I have. And honestly, I've never had a bad experience except for two incidents. I was in Manila and I was in a taxi driver and he had a gun in his hand, which he was sort of twiddling around and asking me odd questions. In those circumstances, I always find sport is a leveller. You know, just chuck in. I always mention that I support Leicester City and they always say, oh, the Mighty Foxes or something. Or you have a very unlucky team there, very unlucky. You know, and we share and we support each other through the gloom of being a Leicester City supporter. Oh, of course, there's always a Man U supporter or a cricket fan in Pakistan, something. You just, if you feel that you're about to be in a difficult situation as a lone female traveller, I think sport or conversation or looking them in the eye and asking them something personal or about something about their country. I think you can get out of all sorts of situations in that kind of difficult environment if you're in a dangerous city.
That's all very well, but a young woman is on her own doing all this. I mean, how daunting was that for you?
I grew up in a noisy household where I had to kind of fight for attention. and I think that actually part of wanting to get away was to be alone. I mean, first of all, I found my own company quite odd, and it took me a while to get to like it. And it took me a while to get used to. Normally, if you see an amazing view, I can remember sitting looking over the Panama Canal and the Bridge of Americas was lit up and I could see all the many boats waiting to do the transit from the Pacific to the Caribbean side. And it looked so beautiful. And I had to get used to not being able to turn to someone and say, wow, would you look at that? You know, can you see? So you do start talking to yourself and behaving a little odd. You get to the point where you'll share those things with yourself. It's quite bizarre. And the safety aspect, I think most British women are quite sensible. And I was probably oversensible initially. And sometimes you miss amazing sunsets because you're afraid of being out too late. I mean, of course, I avoided being out after dark. I didn't drink alcohol or anything in a crazy bar. I didn't, you know, chat to groups of guys. You know, I did sensible things. But I think there's so much more good in the world than there is bad. And I think sometimes we limit our encounters with people because we expect them all to be serial killers. And the way to look at it, I think, is that, you know, you interaction and experience of cultures, languages, foods, people's humour. I always ask people, what is a really great joke in Nicaragua? You know, in Nicaragua, what's a favourite joke? What's a very common way to express humour? And people love sharing those things with you. So the anecdotes, the kind of cultural interaction, you know, they're the things you miss if you're too afraid.
Jumping forward a little bit, you ended up on the Alan Titchmarsh show for 3 years on ITV. I brought my mum actually to see that. We saw that being filmed one time, so we must have crossed at some point. But how did that come about and how did you enjoy that experience?
Well, I really did. And it was really strange because I just had a baby and I was late to motherhood. And I didn't think that I would probably have a child because of the work that I was doing. So it's a big decision for me. I'd spent an extended period of time in the jungle. And because of my advancing years, they put me on a maternal wing, like looking after children, really, people that just hit puberty having babies. And I had some really amazing experiences looking after these young girls who were giving pregnant without any kind of help, just left in a clearing in a beautiful spot in the jungle to give birth naturally. And through those experiences, I started to think about motherhood. And the tribe told me that they could see a little girl sitting on my shoulder waiting to be born. So I came home to England and had a baby and accepted that perhaps the travelling part of my life was over and that I might have to do something very ordinary. And I was just contemplating that with a very young baby when I got a call from ITV asking if I wanted to be their travel and holiday expert. And I thought, okay, this is, again, the luck of the Sarah. You know, maybe there is a way in continuing to do this. I've traveled for nearly 20 years. I've got all sorts of experiences, tips, advice. You know, I know people in the industry. I can talk about holidays. Live television in front of 6 million people is a tricky thing. I wasn't sure if I was cut out for live TV, but he's a great person to work with and he loves travel himself. So we had a very good dynamic and it went from being, it was supposed to be a kind of a fluid setup where he had a number of different travel writers, but I just became his sort of regular fixture. And his enthusiasm for his show and his work ethic is infectious. So it was great. I learned from somebody who loved doing what he did. And so up until the point that he retired from daytime telly, I was there. And it was a great experience.
I mean, you say you thought your travel days might be over when you had Millie. But didn't I read somewhere that you took her with you and went on a was it even in Cyprus that you took Millie and you went all over. Tell us about that. How difficult was that?
So I figured that any child of mine would probably be pretty robust. but I thought perhaps rather than wait until the teenage years, which is what I've got now, and there'd be all sorts of other considerations, to take her young when her eyes would just be wide open and she'd be full of curiosity. And that was the best thing to do. So I stuffed her in a backpack. I mean, a backpack that was made for children, let me just say. And she was amazing. She just loved everything. And because she was very alert as a baby, from day one, she had her eyes open, looking, and she'd stare directly at you. And I think people loved her on the buses and on the trains. And they were always wanting to take her because she was looking and engaging with people and also looking out the window and pointing and clapping. And so she was a great travel companion. I think probably the best I've ever had. And seeing things through a baby's eyes is amazing. So anybody with a big bushy beard at Istanbul train station or the bus station or whatever, she'd look at and she'd laugh and she'd clap and he'd give her chocolate and she was passed back through the bus, you know, and people were singing and she was singing. It was an amazing experience. And we did south of Cyprus on the old Leyland buses before they decommissioned them all. And it was a great experience. And she pretends she doesn't like travel now, but she was up for this adventure. So over COVID, you know, when we were stuck in our top floor flat, wishing that we were somewhere else, I said to her, why don't we move to Cyprus? You know, okay, they've had tough COVID restrictions as well, but at least you can be outside in your garden and you can, you know, see the sea and we can chase lizards around. And she was immediately up for it in the spirit of adventure. So she's a teenager. We have some challenges with that right at the moment, but she still loves to be in different places and she's learning Turkish and she's enjoying the whole adventurous side of this epic experience.
Because she's at the school in Kyrenia, is that right? How's she sort of adapting to that and enjoying that?
She is. So I actually enrolled her for the last, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks of term in whenever it was that we arrived in 2022. So, and people were saying to me, why are you paying the fees for just 6 or 8 weeks? And I said, because I want her to have a great summer with new friends. And it worked. It took a while to get used to the non-British way of answering questions. So she puts her hand up and waits to be politely asked for a response. In Cyprus, everyone just shouts it out, you know. So she has 55 nationalities at her school. Wow. And they're all shouter outers. So she's now learning that she's got to be loud and heard. That if she just puts her hand up meekly, no one's going to, you know, the question will have been and gone. But she's got friends that are, I mean, a variety of different Russian speakers. She has friends from Iran. She has friends from Israel. She has friends from Pakistan. Yeah, all over. And of course, there are some Brits there. So it's been a great experience for her. And she's just thrown herself into it. Yeah,
well, with a mum like you, it's not surprising, really. I mean, it's amazing. And I mean, I guess it's one of those things that, as a child, perhaps you would have liked that experience. I mean, you're sort of giving the experience you would have craved as a child in a way.
In a way, yeah, I'm living my life vicariously through her. I can see that. Yeah, you know, just being thrown into those situations. She's a more cautious child. And I think that's just this generation, you know, a generation that has phones just in case there's an emergency. I mean, you know, we used to go out in the morning, didn't we? And I don't even remember eating. I think I came back in the evening. I mean, people didn't really ever know where I was. But yeah, there's a more phobic generation now. Mm. She likes to be in contact with people. And I think she's fearful when she's not. She's immediately assessing everything based on a health and safety risk, you know. Yeah. So isn't the sea a bit rough, Mum? No, don't be silly, you know. Isn't that a bit high? Isn't there a path? Aren't there steps, you know, whereas, you know, so she's learning just to climb that mountain, just to go down that track. We're very lucky at the Carpas in that it's a place that invites exploration. You know, we went off yesterday to find Millie's sponsored turtle nest here on a beach that at 5 o'clock was completely and utterly deserted. Like a paradise. And, you know, we were scrambling over rocks to get there. And I mean, it's an amazing experience. It's as close to being on a deserted island as it's possible to be up here. So yeah, I think it's within her, and I think it perhaps needs encouraging out, but I don't think she'll ever stop being an adventure in spirit, you know.
Going back to your travel days, Sarah, one of our listeners asked me to ask you your favourite method of travel. I just want to change that a bit and ask you, what's the weirdest method of travel you've ever done? Because, you know, you've done donkeys, haven't you? You've done horses, elephants, oxen cart, all the lot. What's the weirdest travel experience that you can remember?
I think it's perhaps when you're taken to places by a tribe that doesn't want people to find them easily again. So that would happen, say, for example, if I was going to the Amazon, I would take a flight, a tiny little flight, like one of these puddle jumpers, like a mosquito with a fat belly buzzing along over the treetops of the jungle, which just looked like miles and miles and miles of broccoli. That's what it looks like. You can't see anywhere to land a plane. And suddenly you see a tiny little patch of land, and you think, we're going to land on that in the middle of all these. You land on the in the middle of nowhere. There are no electrics or anything in the plane that tell you where to land. The guy gets a piece of paper out of his trousers, which has been through the wash. You can see this bit of paper has been through the wash. And he's getting out the instructions on how to land. And then you land and you think, okay, where now? Because you know that you're miles from anywhere. Then you might perhaps do a walk, or there might be a local indigenous guy with a horse or something. He leads you to a river, which you've not noticed. It's the colour of caramel with streaks of kind of red from the iron. It's an amazing, it doesn't look like a river. It looks like something out of Willy Wonka. You get into a canoe and you're directed for a while up a river you see nothing else on. But you can tell that the river is full of all sorts of fish, snakes, caiman, because there's air bubbles, there's heads of caiman, there's snakes coming out. And then you get to a bank and you're blindfolded. You're turned around a few times as if you know where you are. I mean, I've lost my sense of direction hours before. And then you're taken through thick, kind of gloopy mud. You're losing your boots, but you can't see where you're going. You're holding the hand of someone you've met hours earlier who speaks a strange Amazonian dialect with lots of clicks and tuts and guttural sounds. So your Spanish is virtually useless. And then you eventually are taken to a village and they sit you down on a tree stump. They take off your blindfold and they see what the reaction is to you. So I, in these circumstances, I may have been asked to go there for a day or so. But they want to see what I'm like. They want to see if I have disease, if I have illness. They want to see if I'm carrying bad spirits. They want to feel my aura. They want to, yeah, they want to know what sort of person I am. So I'm sat on this tree stump for hours while people come around and look at me. Then they let the children go. The children have been kind of held in the village and the children come running out to me. And that reaction is really important. Now, I didn't know, but I'd got pink and gold colours around me as my aura, and the children loved that. So they ran straight up to me, sat on my lap, threw their arms around me. And, yeah, I mean, thankfully, I didn't know. I mean, I might have had the dark purple, the black, the grey, the green. That might have been around me. I had no way of knowing. And so then you're accepted. You're viewed with suspicion because you might have, for example, a guy had been a few weeks before from Smithsonian. He was going to study with this particular tribe to learn about the health benefits of the trees and the bark and the roots and the shoots in the jungle. But he had a stubble rash, like a shaving rash. And as soon as they saw him, they turned him away because they did not want that disease within their camp. So I was lucky. And the day that I was supposed to stay there turned into days, turned into weeks, turned into months. They're some of the strangest journeys, the journeys where you don't know if you're going to be accepted by the tribe. You don't know what kind of reaction you're going to have. Imagine if they'd have been absolutely terrified of me. I mean, they have spears. You know, it wasn't that long ago that they were cutting off heads as trophies. You know, so you are literally going in with very few expectations because you don't really know where this is leading. And then to be accepted and to very quickly learn that my nice flat in England, my nice car, my education, my nice family upbringing, it counts for nothing there. What counts for everything is the fact that they have tribe around them. And in numbers, they are strong. In numbers, they are warm. In numbers, they are fed. In numbers, they are loved. In numbers, they go on to create new tribe members, which then, you know, ensures the sustainability of their ethnic group. And the fact that I'm wandering around in my flip-flops on my own at my age makes them feel sorry for me because they pity the fact that I'm away from my tribe, that I don't have any children, that I'm so alone and thousands of miles away from home. And they liken me to the migratory whale or the migratory bird that's on a journey. And they say to me, you know, we hope your travels, your migration is a successful, knowledgeable and fruitful one. And we hope that you're soon back in your home with your own kind and your tribe. And so those journeys are both amazing in terms of the transport, but also amazing in terms of the growth, the development in you, because you realise that your Western science-based fact must have the research type knowledge is actually quite useless there. Trust is everything. And so it's quite humbling to be in the jungle. And I think anybody with any kind of ego needs to spend some time in the jungle. In fact, anybody.
You're there in North Cyprus. So what's the plan now?
Okay, so I still freelance write. So I work for a number of different people. I often get asked to write about Cyprus. So you'll see me travelling around with my notebook and just making voice notes. So I'm still writing. I'm still doing lots. I considered something of a kind of an authority on the Panama Canal because I was there for its handover. So I get lots of work to do with the places that were very dear to me and anything to do with indigenous tribes in the Darien, in the Amazon, or any of those big South and Central American rainforests. I get asked to talk a lot about them and the environmental issues and also the things that we don't understand, shape-shifting, those kind of things, the visions that these tribes base their religion on and the close affinity they have with the jungle. They're the kind of things I get asked to write about these days.
So there we are. That's travel writer extraordinaire Sarah Woods in conversation with us. And I think it says a lot about the TRNC that Sarah has had all those incredible experiences, travelled the world, yet she finds that living in the Karpaz is one of the best place in the world to live. So thank you very much indeed to Sarah for joining us. And hopefully we'll chat to her again at some other time.
Yeah, and she has got a website, Sarah. Sarah Woods, and it's S-A-R-A-H, sarahwoods.co.uk. And you'll find lots more about her writing and all the other things that she's done in her career, all concerning, of course, travel and the travel industry.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much indeed to Sarah for this episode. Thank you to you for listening as well. Please do subscribe wherever you're listening and then you'll know when our next episode comes out. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Talking Round North Cyprus. You can always drop us an email as well. That's trnc.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Sarah Palmer.
And I'm Roger Barr. Look forward to talking with you again very, very soon.